Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Are you missing what matters most in your marriage?
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views, or half hour, depends on how things go. Well, they're going to be the views of Buck Keeley, and Buck, of course, has an organization known as Seed Catalog, and he sells seeds for people to begin storing away in case they need them at some later time. And also, he gives people advice as to how to grow things. Hi, Buck. How are we doing?
I'm doing great, Dr. Stan. Thank you for having me on again.
Well, it's getting about that time of year when people start thinking about planting their gardens. I went down to the hardware store today and looked around, and they had all sorts of little tiny tomato plants and other plants that are really beginning to come in. So this is the time, at least in certain parts of the country, people ought to start thinking about planting, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's time for most of the country now to either be planting some things or preparing for that. This is the time of the year that you start to put in your potatoes and your cold crops for lettuces and radishes and turnips and beets and your green English peas and Japanese peas, those kinds of things. All of those things are time to start going in. Onions in a big part of the country. If you're zone 5A and higher, there's several plants you could be preparing to put out today.
Well, now, why don't you explain to our listeners what Area 5 is? A lot of people don't understand these terms that you use so glibly.
Well, the zoning of the country is due to frost date and when you could plant. And so depending where you're at in the country, you're going to have a zone that for planting that's been assigned to you from a 1 to a 9. And if you'll go to our site, seedcatalog.com, and click on any of the categories for the vegetable seed, there'll be a link that'll take you to a website that we have that will show you what zone you're in. And there'll also be a planting schedule to show you what time that you plant in your zone. For an example, where we're at here in southern Oregon, we're in a kind of a microclimate, and we're in a 7B zone, which puts us pretty close to you. And so where we're at now, our last known frost is the last week of May. But our average frost is the second week of May. And so that you work off that zone chart to know when your last likely day of frost is. And that's where you work your planting, those that are cold hardy and those that are not. And so that's what a zone chart is.
Well, now, basically, we're in the central coast of California. Would we be about the same way you are down by the ocean? So we don't get that much frost here, do we?
No, you're probably, I'd have to look at the zone chart, you're probably an 8B, which puts you to where you have a low likelihood of frost happening any time. We're a little higher than that. We have the coastal influences, but we're a little further north than you. But there's a microclimate. We live here in a donut hole, which the surrounding areas, that they have a later frost date than we do. So depending where you live, we'll tell you where your zone is. And it's always good to network with other gardeners. You find other experienced gardeners in your area, and there's little hints, like where we're at, you don't plant your tomatoes until the Saddleback Mountains has a snow gone. So the little colloquialisms like that will help you know about planting.
All right, fine. Well, basically, of course, that's seedcatalog.com. Is that right, seedcatalog.com, that go to get those charts? And, of course, our guest is Buck Keeley. If you have a question or comment, don't be bashful. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But, of course, now is the time to get that soil ready, and you're going to have to start thinking about putting in all of these things. Whether suddenly where we are, we have a little greenhouse, we want to start thinking about putting some things in there. But one of the most important things is to start thinking about storing seeds and have them in a condition where you can store them, because if we were to have a catastrophe, you wouldn't be able to get them.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
You may have heard about the 90 essential nutrients or the Mighty 90 needed for good health. But with all the products out there, what exactly are they talking about? The Mighty 90 is 16 vitamins, 12 amino acids, 60 plant-derived minerals, and 2 essential fatty acids. So, now you know. But with all the products you see and hear advertised, what exactly do you buy to come up with the Mighty 90 and the right ratios to promote good health? Youngevity has made it easy with the Healthy Start Pack, which contains one canister of Beyond Tangy Tangerine Vitamin and Plant-Derived Mineral Complex, one bottle of Bone and Joint Enriching OsteoFX Plus, and one bottle of EFA Plus Essential Fatty Acids, all in the proper ratios to promote good health and vitality. For more information or to order, call 1-800-991-8730. That's 1-800-991-8730 and ask about business opportunities.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Buck is basically saying that if you're going to be planting your tomatoes, or most of your seeds, at least tomatoes and peppers, what you want to do is put them in planting soil, little containers, and put them in the dark. And certainly you can actually do that with a black bag over the top of them, or you can put them on top of your water heater. That's a good area. Of course, the black bag keeps them in the dark for 5 or 6 days. And after that, of course, you can take that out. Ordinarily, at the end of 5 or 6 days, if they've been warm and wet, why, the little plants will begin to break through the ground. And then at that point, they need sun. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. What happens when the plants break out of the ground, the seed has everything it needs in it for it to germinate. And if you've ever sprouted seed, you'll understand this, that you take your seeds when you sprout them and you put water on them and you keep them damp and you put them in dark. And what happens is that they pop up and they grow. And the last day you have your sprouts out, you put them in sunlight. So photosynthesis takes place. They turn a little green. So in the tomato plants, what happens when the soil temperature is the right temperature, around 75 degrees, and they've got the moisture content that you need for the seed to germinate, the moisture and the heat come together, and that seed begins to reproduce itself, and it breaks out, and it makes a little root base, and it pops up with its first leaves. And when those first leaves break through the ground, they continue to grow even without light until you get your second set of leaves. And the second set of leaves that comes up is actually the leaves that begins the process of photosynthesis, where the chlorophyll is made from the process of the nutrients from the soil and from the sun or from the light. So once those seeds come up and they're out of the ground, they need to have light, and particularly when that first set of true leaves comes up.
Well, it would be better to actually have these certainly out in on the ground. Would it be better if we actually have a little plastic greenhouse? Oh, would we do well to actually put some of these things in the plastic greenhouse, like the tomatoes and peppers, or simply just leave them outside? Which would be best? Where would they grow the best?
Well, it depends on what part of the country you have and what kind of weather you have. There's a new farming technique that's being used. It's row cropping with hoop houses, and they leave the plants under plastic year-round so that you would transplant your plants underneath the hoops inside the plastic, and it provides an artificial dome environment where the moisture content is better, and that in the cool time of the year, in the early spring, you have more protection from the cold. So it works well. We do both here. We grow under plastic, and we grow in the garden. And certainly in the garden requires less maintenance than it does in the greenhouse, if you're dealing with full nutrient soil. So it depends on how you want to grow. But the most important thing is starting garden. If you're not gardening now, you need to start now. There'll be a time that you're going to need this, and you can't. It's like learning how to survive in the wilderness when you've been left in the wilderness. You need to learn before you get out there. And gardening is something that you need to develop the skills around while you have the luxury of failure.
All right. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 if you've got a question for Buck. So basically, we could start at least in our area beginning to put in the tomato seeds, the pepper seeds. Now, what about, certainly you mentioned certain types of lettuce. Would those go into the ground at this time as well?
Yeah, most parts of the country, your lettuce and your radishes and your turnips and your beets and your onions can all be put in now. And just a little, one of the problems that people have gardening is seeds are very, very small. And so particularly things like radish seeds or onion seeds or beet seeds, that people have a tendency when they sow them, they have these thick rows, and they come back and they're trying to pull out the excess to get the spacing right. If you'll just mix yourself up a little bit of flour and water and cut strips of newspaper about an inch wide, and every 3 inches put a dab of this flour and water mixture onto that piece of paper, spread your seeds on top of that, and then just shake them off onto another piece of paper below, you'll have the perfect spacing for your onions or your radishes or your turnips. If you're doing radishes, you plant them about 2 inches apart. If they're turnips, about 6 inches apart. Onions, about 6 inches apart. So you just do that on strips of newspaper and then bury those in your garden. And that way you have perfect spacing. You're not wasting seeds coming back and thinning them out because they're heavily sowed. So this is a good time for people to start making those sowing strips, and just take newspapers, cut them in 1 inch wide strips. Every 4 to 6 inches, put a dab of flour and water mixture. And then if you remember when you were a kid, that's how we made our glue. And you spread your seeds on top of that, and the flour and water will hold that one seed, and you spread the rest of them off below on another sheet of paper and save them, put them back in your seed pack, and you'll use a lot less seed and have a easier to maintain garden.
All right, fine. Well, now, basically, then what about getting the, in case where we have people who want to go out and buy the little plants, at what point should we do that if we were going to get the plants down at the hardware store or something like that?
If you're putting in non-cold hardy plants like tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, squash, those kind of things, you want to buy them after the last known frost. You don't want to buy them and put them out early because the chance of losing the frost. But except, along with that, until the soil temperature gets up to around 60 degrees, they don't do any good anyway. They just sit in the ground. A lot of times they'll get root rot and die. So you don't want to put them out too early. You want to wait until last known frost is over, springtime has come, and then plant them. As far as what you ought to put in is transplants. A lot of people spend a lot of money on transplants that is pretty useless. For an example, squashes and cucumbers and vine plants do not transplant very well. They're very difficult to get a good transplant on. And the best thing to do for those is plant seeds. And within a week, you'll have the plant up. And within 3 weeks, you'll have a better plant than what you transplanted. So those kind of things I wouldn't buy transplants for. About the only thing I would buy transplants for would be the tomatoes and peppers, the tropical plants that require conditioning before you plant them. The rest of the plants I would put in by seed.
All right, well, now, of course, it's time to think about getting the soil ready. And I was down there. I saw that the local store manure mix, a small sack of it for $1.50, something like that. Is that something good? Now, we'll be planting predominantly in fairly large boxes, a foot wide or maybe 3 feet long, something like that. So basically, should we be adding the manure mix to that? What should we be doing? Should we be adding compost to the boxes? What should we be doing to prepare the soil?
Yeah, preparing the soil, that manures are good. If you're doing container gardening like you're doing, you can buy the small bags, 1.5 cubic foot bags at your local gardening store. Make sure that it's an organic manure. Make sure it's not sterilized. Manure, that you want to have good organic manure so that it builds the soil. And at the same time, composting. The composting is the answer to most garden problems. It builds the soil, provides nutrients for the plant. So this is the time that before you plant, that you build your soil, that we have begun the process for this year's planting here, and we've come in and we've been spreading compost that we've made through the year. And then also we've had composting wood chips that's been in our garden for about the last 3 months, and we just spread those, and it provides good basic nutrients and it holds the water in for your plant. So composting and manures are all good. If you buy manure, make sure that you don't get horse manure. Horse manure, the way that the horse's stomachs work, the seed passed through the system, and you're going to have all kinds of grass and weeds coming up for the horse manure. The best thing to use is cow manure. And just as a side note on that, please do not ever put green manure in your garden at planting time. The green manure needs at least 3 months to season and to deteriorate to the point where E. coli cannot be transferred. You never want to put fresh manure on a garden that's active. You want to use that at the end of the year when you harvest your garden and you're building soil for next year. So if you're putting in manure, make sure that it is seasoned manure, at least 3 months old.
Well, they actually talk about manure mix now. What do they mean by that?
A manure mix will be a mix with manure and with other things like cocoa fiber, or with zonite or other materials in it that lightens it up, that makes it a more of a rather than a soil builder, it makes it a soil augmentation, and so they add other ingredients to the manure to make it a lighter, easier to use product.
All right, now why don't you tell our listeners how they get in touch with you, how they could get certainly seeds for planting this year, how they can get seeds for storage, because I think that's one of the most important things people can do is start preparing, make sure that you have seeds in case suddenly there is a catastrophic event, an EMP attack, an attack, a financial collapse. Any one of a number of things could create a situation where you might have to begin relying upon yourself to plant, to be able to plant a garden to survive. So why don't you tell people how they can get in touch with you, get your website, and begin laying in a supply of seeds to use this year and, of course, for some untoward event. Again, our number, if you'd like to call in, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, but go ahead, Buck.
Okay, first of all, how you find us is on the World Wide Web. Just go to your browser, type into the address bar, seedcatalog.com, all one word, seedcatalog.com. You can also find us at a toll-free number of 1-888-866-9132, 1-888-866-9132. That's where you'll reach us, either on the World Wide Web or by phone. And as far as the seed, that we're already having some problems getting seed. We've lost some of our suppliers because of the drought last year, and as well as there's been a heightened understanding of the need of heirloom seed. So we've lost suppliers due to the drought, and we've lost supplier due to product being sold. That along with that, prices are escalating with everything else.
Well, hold that thought. Give us a call if you're out there in the audience.
Your body is composed of literally trillions of cells. Cells are the building blocks of energy and performance for your health and for the life you want to live. Nutritional Therapeutics, a trusted manufacturer of vitamin supplements, understands that when cells aren't operating at optimum levels, one of the immediate signs is an increase in fatigue. Propax is a daily multiple vitamin enhanced with our proprietary formula called NT Factor. Less fatigue equals more natural energy. Propax with NT Factor addresses cellular damage and gives you health from nature, energy from science. Call today at 1-800-982-9158. Try Propax with NT Factor. Call 1-800-982-9158. Order yours today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure, or prevent any disease.
Americans love pills. America's 40 million seniors will have consumed 1.6 trillion pills during their lifetime, not counting vitamin pills. This is health journalist Bill Sardi. Americans are living longer an additional 18 years after they reach age 65. How will senior Americans spend that time? You've got it. Taking more and more pills to treat more and more disease. We need a better approach. How about a pill that promotes health rather than treats disease? That's where a pill I formulated comes in. It's called Longevinix, and it's a well-tested combination of herbs and vitamins proven to trigger genes activated by a limited-calorie diet, even mimicking physical exercise. Longevinix promotes healthy vision, heart pumping, immune response, blood clotting, and even mood. Call 1-866-405-4000 to order today. Healthy aging. Longevinix. Get started before you grow old. Call now 1-866-405-4000.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Do you enjoy cooking? Would you like to learn the culinary secret that Barbara uses to enhance the flavor of Dr. Stan's food? Who's Barbara? She's Dr. Stan's wife. And what's her secret? She uses the delicious spices produced by Old Westport Spice and Trading Company. After using and enjoying their products for almost 20 years, Dr. Stan and Barbara decided they should offer their favorites to you. If you would like to please your family and enhance the flavor of your food, call 800-544-8927. That's 800-544-8927. I suggest you call today. Once again, the telephone number is 800-544-8927. 800-544-8927.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Buck is saying that there's a shortage of seeds this year for several reasons. One is the fact that certainly there was a terrible drought last year, and a lot of the people just didn't have very good crops. And these are small farmers, these are not corporate farmers, and that's where they get the heirloom seeds from. Then, of course, the big corporate companies are trying to control the seeds, and basically they want to control all the seeds, and so many of the seeds that you can buy now in the store are only going to come up 1 year, and then you're not going to be able to reproduce them. In other words, the seeds that are produced on the crops you grow this year, you won't be able to utilize for next year. But of course, this, and then Buck is saying that more and more people are becoming aware of the fact that we are facing potential problems, and there's just laying in seed supplies. And basically last year, why the utilization of heirloom seeds was up about 30 or 40%, but this year a lot of the seeds aren't available. They're actually having to take some of the seeds down off their website. They just can't get them, but they can still get a good supply of seeds. So basically, once again, how can people reach you, Buck?
You can find us on the World Wide Web by typing in your address bar, seedcatalogs.com, seedcatalog.com. And also on Dr. Stan's site, if you click onto the heirloom link site, it'll take us to our website. And you can also reach us toll-free at 1-888-866-9132, 1-888-866-9132.
And, of course, you can go to our website, and there's a link there from our website to Buck's website. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464, if you have a question at all for Buck. And it's important, I think, that people begin to learn how to grow things so that you could take care of yourself, and at least you could have some food for yourself and your neighbors if something disastrous should occur. And right now is the time when there's no pressure on at all to begin making your preparations. Now, what about long-term seed storage? Do you have facilities for that? Do you have packets? Why don't you tell our listeners about what you're offering for long-term seed storage?
The concept of preparation, you have three different concepts that you have to prepare for. One is immediate. One is off. Immediate, something that you put aside that you can put your hands on and use tomorrow, and then long-term. And the long-term seed storage is crucial, that all it takes is one legislative movement. And anybody who's been fighting the raw milk and the fresh meat on the government side, one of the things we're dealing with is that we raise poultry and rabbits. And there's a movement to stop us from being able to sell those to the public. We've had many legislative battles fought over that. And the same thing for the raw milk folks, to understand the battles that's been fought over that. Well, what's happening with the seed? There's battles being fought over making seed certifiable by the government to make sure that they have control over it. And if that happens, if you don't have seed, you're done. And so the long-term seed storage is for an EMP if that would happen, or if we have a financial collapse, or if we have government regulation come in. That you have seed that has been prepared for storage for up to 20 years. And what we sell is we sell what we call our seed bank. And we have three different types of seed banks. We have the basic seed bank, which has enough seed and grain in it, that's heirloom seed, sustainable, renewable. You can collect the seed off this food and replant it. The basic seed bank will plant about an acre. And then we have a personal seed bank, which will plant about a half acre of vegetables and grain, and then we'll let you build your own seed bank. If you buy more than $50 worth of seeds, we'll package for you in our seed bank. And what the seed bank is, it's drywall PVC that's sealed, impervious to water and to light. And the three things that destroy seed is heat, light, and water. So what you do with this seed bank, you throw it in your freezer, you bury it in your backyard down a foot or two deep so that the temperature moderation keeps the same, put it in a root cellar, someplace to where the seed has a constant temperature that's cool, and the seed bank provides the dry atmosphere where the seeds are never exposed to moisture. And the seeds over 7 to 10 years will lose part of its germination, but after 20 years, you'll still have 50% germination or more on all the seeds. So that's your ultimate survival if something goes wrong, is the long-term storage seed bank.
All right, well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And what seeds, what sort of seeds do you have in the seed bank?
The seed banks will have a cross-section on the basic seed bank of all of the varieties. There'll be a half dozen or so different tomato plants, and pepper plants. It'll have cucumber plants, squash plants. It'll have as well in it cabbage plants and cauliflower plants. It'll have corn in it as well. It'll have grain, wheat grain in it as well. It'll have eggplant in it. It'll have onions in it. All the basic garden vegetables that you would want to plant.
All right, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Give us a call if you have a question.
While a storm cloud gathers far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices in a solemn prayer.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Buck Keeley. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. You got a question for Buck? Now, Buck said we did a program last year where we talked about worms. And suddenly my son was intrigued by that. He got a worm grower, and he's actually got a little case up there in the kitchen. He's growing worms. It's just full of worms. Now, certainly, do those worms, would they help in the garden? Could we put them in these planting containers we have, 3 feet long, foot wide, or should we save those for putting in an open garden? What can we do with those worms? Because we sure got a lot of them here.
A sign of a healthy garden is earthworms show up. That's where you have a good composting garden. Worms are God's own created composting machines. And what they do is that they break down the compost to the finest elements where the plants can immediately pick it up. And there's two ways to approach that, getting the worm castings in your garden. If you're flat gardening, opening gardening, If you keep your soil composted, you're going to notice worms are going to come in and they multiply like crazy. And as long as there's plenty of food for there to eat, they're going to continue to build your garden. So that's a great way to build your garden is by composting. The worms come in. If you're going to bring worms in, the most prevalent worm that's sold on the internet is what they call the red wiggler. And they're great composters, but they're not good survivors. They won't survive in the outdoors very well. They have to have a good temperature to survive. And so don't buy those. If you're going to buy worms, buy night crawlers. But if you don't have a good soil, they're going to just migrate someplace else. They're going to leave you. So rather than buy the worms, if you're flat gardening, compost your garden. They'll come to you, as they say, build it and they will come. If you're container gardening like Dr. Stan is, the danger of putting worms directly into your compost is that if you take your soil to rebuild it or to replace it, you're going to lose your worms. So that's an issue you have to deal with if you're going to put worms directly into your growing boxes. If you have the worm farm, if you have the setup where you're growing worms, what happens is they produce castings, the worm food, and you can put that directly into your gardens and it'll benefit them greatly. Or you can make a tea out of that by taking a cup or two of your worm castings, putting it in water and aerating it by rotating it every 3 or 4 hours for 12 hours. What will happen is those castings that you put in there, the microbial growth will go crazy. And you put the tea directly onto your garden. You pour the water onto your plant, and it instantly goes to the roots. And it's amazing the difference that that makes by using worm peel.
Okay, well, if you have any question for Buck, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And are you out there? Are you beginning to learn how to grow a vegetable garden? Do you think it's important? Do you think that this is something that we should be talking about? Well, I personally do. I really have been watching things that are going on. Certainly the whole world economy is on the verge of collapse. Certainly they're having terrible times in Europe now, certainly. And here in America, they keep telling us things are getting better, but they're really not getting better. We've never gotten out of the recession. And we don't know what sort of cataclysmic event there might occur, either spontaneously or God bringing his punishment on this country. But people are going to have to start thinking about how they will survive. If this wonderful utopian world we live in just isn't there any longer. And one of the things that's interesting, and actually it's sort of fun, actually to actually work in the garden, and I certainly do enjoy it. Our telephone number, if you have a question for Buck, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. 464-8295 here in the Central Coast of California. But one thing that Buck makes such a point of is the importance of actually having your soil prepared. And of course, he believes that compost, and I'm sure he's right, compost certainly does the best possible job. Now, can you mix the compost with regular soil? What should you do? And once you have it in containers, should you throw it away after 1 year or 2 years? What should you do?
Well, let's start with composting. It's a lot of folks think it's a difficult thing to do, and it's really not. There's two types of composting, cold composting and hot composting. Cold composting is as simple as taking organic material, carbon and nitrogen. Carbon is brown, nitrogen is green. Grass clippings, leaves that have fallen, cardboard, plant material that you pulled up, that's dried, and putting it in a pile and just letting it set there for a year. In about 8 to 10 months, it turns into compost. Hot composting is where you put it in a container. Something as simple as three pallets that you nail together, or you take some wire, make a circle out of it, or something more expensive where you go down to the store and you buy a drum. And that's the same thing. It's nitrogen and it's carbon, brown and green. And you mix it in there and you keep it damp and you turn it every couple of weeks. And about 6 weeks, then you have compost. And all compost is organic material that has the mix between nitrogen and carbon. It causes a chemical reaction which causes heat, and it breaks down those components to where they're a moist, fine product. That's what compost is. You can put your kitchen waste in it. Don't put meat products in it. It'll bring animals into it. You don't want that. But your green compost or your leftover vegetables or your leftover macaroni and cheese, put it on your compost pile. Don't throw that away. Just take it out back, corner your garden, pile it up there and let it set for the year you got compost. Then you take that compost and you introduce it into your garden. And if you're container gardening like Dr. Stan is, that before you plant your plants, you put a layer of compost on top of it and you take your hand fork and you turn it into the soil and you mix the soil together. And that provides nutrients to the soil that's there. If you're flat gardening, you're gardening out in your backyard, you take the compost and you put it on top of your soil. You take a fork and you turn it in, or you rototiller it in, or do what we do. We don't turn it into the soil. We build our soil every year, and we just plant directly into the compost. And compost can be things as well. If you have resources to manure, you take and you put the cow manure on your compost pile. You can put grass clippings on there or straw on there, whatever you have, anything that is natural, green or brown, put it on your compost pile, then introduce that into your garden. And that's what composting is, and that builds your soil. And then once you have the soil built, you fertilize to feed your plants. So you use a good organic fertilizer, and once your plants are in the ground, that you fertilize when you plant them, and then as they start to produce fruit, you fertilize them again every couple of weeks while they're producing, and that gives you a good, strong, healthy plant.
Now, basically, you say we fertilize every couple of weeks. How do we do that? How do we fertilize them, and what do we fertilize them with? And is it in liquid form, or is it just something we sprinkle around us at the base of the plant?
Well, there's two ways to fertilize. One is direct fertilization through water, and the second is dry fertilization with for slow release. And so it kind of depends what your plant is. Like corn, if you're fertilizing your corn, you want to use a dry fertilizer so that over a period of time that the water puts it down into the soil and goes to the roots, and you have a longer time that lasts, because a corn plant takes a considerable amount of time once that you plant it till it's producing the ears of corn. On the other hand, things like tomatoes, once they start producing tomatoes, that if you give them water-based fertilizer, and once again, that could be a worm tea, that could be a natural fertilizer that you mix with water and reduce it down to where it's breaking down the organic matter so it goes into the roots quicker. It's going to go into those tomato plants faster. So tomato plants, I generally use either a rabbit food tea or worm food tea. And then we have organic fertilizer we put together. I put the dry fertilizer down on the plant, and then I use the wet every couple of weeks on there so that it advances the growth of the fruit.
All right. Well, Barbara asked, is there anything that you should not put into your compost pile? Because you'd already said meat, things like that. But is there anything else you should not put into the compost pile?
You should not put anything into your compost pile that's had a chemical spray on it. If you put a chemical spray on your yard, for example, a lot of people have a yard service come out and they spray their yards for weeds. That should, the trimmings from that grass should not go into your compost pile, because you're putting then those chemicals into your soil. I'm a firm believer you ought to be as natural as possible. And so if you're spraying poison on your grass to kill weeds, don't put those weeds into your trimmings off that grass into your compost pile. If there's been Roundup used to kill unwanted weeds or plants, don't pull those plants up, put them in your compost pile, because you're putting poison in there. So that's the important thing. Meat won't hurt your compost pile. It stinks. It won't hurt the compost pile. So what it'll do is it'll bring in rodents and animals from the neighborhood, or if you live in a rural area, animals that are wild out in the woods. You don't want those coming in to your compost pile and tearing your compost pile up, as well as threatening your other animals. So you don't want to put protein products such as meats in there. But about anything else, you don't want to put any styrofoam in it. Cardboard is great, even if it has printing on it. Newspaper is great, even if it has printing on it, because it's soy-based print. Compost with cardboard newspaper is wonderful. It composts quickly. It's a carbon-based, and it helps balance out the green that you put in. But mainly, anything that's been sprayed with poisons or anything that's been made with with photocarbons or anything like that, you know, the styrofoams you don't want to use.
Well, now, is there anything that you shouldn't put in with your worms? Is there anything that'll bother them?
Same thing. Your worms don't want to put any styrofoam in. They can't ingest the styrofoam. Wet newspaper, they'll destroy that. Cardboard, same thing. Shredded up cardboard, they'll destroy that. They love leaves. They love kitchen waste. But anything that's been chemically treated or anything that has photocarbons in it, you don't want to put in it. And you don't want to put any meat products in there. The worms will not eat the meat product, and it'll get rancid, and it'll actually deteriorate your worm farm.
All right, well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And basically, of course, Buck is saying that they're having difficulty getting certain of the heritage seeds. Now, basically, of course, you go down to the local nursery, and they have all sorts of seeds there. But those aren't heritage seeds that they have in the packages, are they, or at the hardware store?
There are some. With this resurgence of heirloom seeds, there has been some hardware stores, and even some of the big box stores are carrying some heirloom seeds to cater to folks. But the trouble with that is you don't know where those seeds come from, that you don't know whether they were naturally grown. You don't even really know if they're heirloom because they're packaged, you know, in China or someplace like that. That if you want to buy heirloom seeds, that stay away from the big box stores, go to your local garden centers, and if you're going to buy them locally, they'll have a limited supply there. They won't have the inventory that we have because that your local gardening store is going to sell maybe 200 packs a year of seeds, where we're going to sell 20,000.
Well, so, why don't you get your telephone number out once more, your website out, so people will know how to get in touch with you. And if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. But why don't you go ahead and get your information out one more time.
The best way to find us is on the World Wide Web. If you have internet access, type into your address bar, seedcatalog.com. That'll take you to our website. That's our front door. You're going to have a lot of good articles on heirloom seeds, the importance of non-GMO growing, and then click on Shop for Seeds, and that'll take you into our store. And there you're going to find our value packs that we put together for small or large gardens, as well as for our basic seed banks or personal seed banks. You'll have a lot of information on your seeds. It's important for you to be able to have time to browse and look through it. So if you have internet access, the best way to discover our seeds and to enjoy our site is through the internet. If you don't have internet connectivity, give us a call at 1-888-866-9132, 1-888-866-9132, and we'll send you out a catalog that'll have all of our seeds in it, but it's not near as helpful as the website because we have a lot of links on when to plant and how to plant and information on the seeds that you won't get in the catalog. So if you have internet access, the best way to explore us is through the internet.
And, of course, Buck's on the front lines of this because that's what he does. He grows vegetables and he grows seeds, and he has his own facilities for growing them up there in Oregon. And so, basically, I feel very, very comfortable in recommending his products to you. We've used them in the past. We've enjoyed them. And I'll tell you one thing. I'm really amazed at how rapidly those radishes come up. They come up in an awful hurry, don't they?
Oh, my goodness. Those are prolific. And they're one of the easiest things to grow, and they're early, and it's wonderful in early spring to go out in the garden and pull some delicious radishes. I like to put mine with a little salt on them and a little bacon fat. You know, the Southern boys in our bacon. And they are a wonderful source of good, fresh vegetables.
Well, now, what about the squash? When should we start thinking about putting in squash?
There's two types of squash. There's the summer squash and the winter squash. Both of those need to go in after first frost. Your summer squash, once you plant them, within 6 to 8 weeks, you're going to have these beautiful vining plants with squash coming on them, the yellow crookneck and zucchini and buttercup. We have 9 or 10 varieties of summer squash. And they come on early summer, and they produce prolifically as long as you keep them picked off. Don't let your squash grow big. The 2-foot-long zucchini is a killer to the plant because they think they're done. and they'll quit producing new plants. So pick the squash when they're young and tender. And then sometime towards August, late August, early September, your winter squash that you planted right after first frost are going to be putting on these big, huge, if they're like a Hubbard squash or they're a butternut squash or a lot of your pumpkins are actually squash, some of them up to 30 and 40 pounds, and they store well through the winter. So you'll start getting those end of August, first of September to harvest.
All right, fine. So basically, of course, this is the time at least to start thinking about planting. But the most important thing is right now to get that soil ready for you. We're talking about certainly most of the things should be planted, certainly what by May, but right probably if you're in an area like we are, or we could even start planting right fairly soon, couldn't we?
Yes, that we're planting now our early crops, turnips and radishes and beets and peas we're putting out right now.
All right, fine. Well, Buck will be back again. We'll be having him on all during the growing season here, hopefully. But my suggestion is start thinking about getting some long-term seeds and get them buried and certainly have a good supply for yourself and other members of your family. But certainly you want to think about the possibility that something catastrophic could happen. And I'll tell you what, Sydney, it's far better off to have the seeds a couple of years too early than one day too late. Well, Buck, God bless you. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again here real soon.
Blessing you, Doctor.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And I need to remind you at this point that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported. And if you're out there across America, across the world, listening to us, in your position to help, we'd love to have you subscribe to our newsletter, join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, where you get our four best tapes in the month and our monthly newsletter, or simply get our products, or if you'd like to donate to us, whatever you can do. But if you're not in a position to help us financially, then we do ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, because, believe me, I'm glad we're still here after almost 20 years. I know a number of the people I've interviewed are no longer with us, certainly the CIA assassins. We don't know what we know. One of them is dead, and the other one has just simply disappeared, the ones we interviewed. And other people we've talked to, a number of them have had very strange exits from this world. But we're still here, and I really attribute that in large part to the fact that I know we have thousands of people praying for us on a regular basis. So if you certainly believe in what we're doing and you would like to support us and you can't support us financially, please pray for us, for our provision and our protection, my staff, my family, and of course for our effort to educate the American people. And it's amazing how often when we'll talk to people and they'll call, or I'll call them, how often they'll say, "And doctor, we are praying for you." And I do deeply appreciate it. Well, certainly if you have not certainly read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, let me recommend it to you. It will help you to understand how this movement towards world government could have been around for thousands of years, and yet it seems to be coming to a climax now. Other people have tried to unite the world, whether it be Genghis Khan or certainly Alexander the Great conquered the world. They told he died of a broken heart because there were no more countries to conquer. Certainly Napoleon tried to unite the world. Hitler tried to unite the world. But no one has come as close to uniting the world as Cecil John Rhodes. Because Cecil John Rhodes created a secret society back in 1891 to unite the world. And of course, they operated initially out of England. Eventually, they came to embrace the United States. And then they transferred the leadership of the movement to the United States following the First World War and the moral and financial bankruptcy of England from that senseless carnage which had been brought about by these members of the secret society who wanted to bring about world peace. And so how do you bring about world peace? Why you wage wars? And the reason, of course, that we had World War II is because the League of Nations failed, so they had to bring about certainly World War II. And what few people understand, in fact, I really found it very hard to believe, when I went through Colonel House's papers at Yale, found a letter from the American ambassador to Germany during World War I, Ambassador William Dodd, and he writes this letter to Colonel House, and he said, "Why are 100 American corporations, building the weapons for the Germans here? Nobody wants another war." Now the letter's dated 1936, and certainly you can just request it. We'll be glad to send you a copy of that. I think we probably have a copy of that in our Agenda 21 syllabus. But be that as it may, we have this letter. And of course, our good friend Professor Sutton, who is a fellow at Hoover University, until of course he began telling the truth, and then they had to get rid of him. In fact, basically after he testified before the Republican convention back in 1972, I think it was, we got back to Stanford after telling people about how we were financing the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese all during the Vietnam War. He got back to Stanford. His name was gone from the door of his office. His telephone was disconnected. And they made his life miserable for letting people know how we financed the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese during the Vietnam War. And we did the same thing with the Germans during World War II, as we're doing the same things with the Muslim terrorists today. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our web address is radioliberty.com. Please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty, our provision, and our protection.
Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices,
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you of the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And for the next hour, as always at this time of the week, the views will be those of William Grigg, former senior editor of the New American Magazine, subsequently editor of the Republic Magazine for a time, and then, of course, more recently, a regular writer for Lou Rockwell. You get his articles up on the Internet. And, of course, he writes the Radio Liberty monthly newsletter, basically. I'm getting to the point where I just don't have the time, and I have another project I'm taking on. And so it's really a great privilege for me to have William writing the Radio Liberty newsletter. I will tell you that the last two newsletters, Radio Liberty newsletters, are amazing. I suggest you read them. We're just getting the January newsletter will be going out in a few days. I know it's all ready to go. It's just a matter of getting in the envelopes and getting it shipped. But we hope that you'll get this information. You're welcome to copy our newsletters and circulate them. They are posted at RadioLiberty.com. RadioLiberty.com, we get them up as soon as we can. Remember, we have a small staff, my wife, my son. We have a couple of people who come in and work part-time for us. So we sometimes are a little negligent in getting things posted on the Internet, but we try to get them there. If you haven't been to our website, why, of course, there's all sorts of fascinating information. Certainly you can read my newsletters going back to the mid-1990s, and they cover all sorts of subjects, many of which we put into pamphlets, with four or five newsletters there that almost be capable of becoming books. But basically to cover all sorts of subjects which you need to read and to understand. And they will help you understand that there's a small group of very wealthy and powerful people who are subversives. They're working here at the highest levels of our government. There are not very many of them, but they're organized and they make mockery of our electoral process. They control both political parties, and suddenly it doesn't really matter whether it's Republicans or Democrats. We always continue the same foreign policies. And certainly, George Bush starts a war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Barack Obama keeps our troops there over, supposedly pulled our troops out of Iraq. But if you really think that we don't have a significant military force still there, you're sadly mistaken. And, of course, they tell us they're going to pull the troops out of Afghanistan. But, see, we're not going to be able to afford to do that, they just announced today. Because, of course, the cutback in financing for the military means we're not going to have enough money to train the Afghan troops. So we're just going to have to leave our troops there in Afghanistan. Oh, shucks. Well, let's go to William Grigg. And good evening, William. How are you tonight?
Dr. Stan, it's always a blessing to be with you. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, what are we going to be talking about tonight?
I think it'd be a good idea perhaps to hitch a ride on the end of the conversation that you were having toward the end of your monologue there about the continuity that characterizes the ruling elite and the fact that this ruling elite is completely foreign to the traditions that define our country, our morality, our sense of what the law really is, the purposes of the law, the fact that we're endowed with unalienable rights as individuals and the government is supposed to be the servant and protector of those rights. And the fact that the people ruling us look upon us as chattel at very best. And this has been something which has continued irrespective of which flavor of collectivist is in the Oval Office. And it's gotten to the point now where we have an unabashed elected dictatorship right now, supported by an oligarchy that is completely amoral. And no good will come from this, and things this year are going to get very, very nasty because of these facts.
And Beck, they control both political parties, ladies and gentlemen. There's not a dime's worth of difference between the two parties, but you're not supposed to understand that. We'll be back in a moment. Go right ahead, William.
there's not a dime's worth of difference, even if you're talking about the relatively worthless manganese slugs that are now used as dimes. There's not an inflation-depleted dime's worth of difference, let alone an actual silver-mercury head dime's worth of difference between these two retail outlets for the wholesale establishment that is the power elite's referred to, the brother of darkness, however you want to designate that self-perpetuating oligarchy. And by way of illustrating this, I think it's useful, timely, and important to discuss what's going on with the presidential assassination power. It amazes me to the depths of my being that 3 or 4 months ago, there were these coy intimations and hints about the obvious practice of discretionary killing by the President of the United States. And Dr. Stan, we've talked about this before. You've related experiences you've had with people who were hired assassins in the service of three-letter agencies working for the executive branch of the United States government in decades past. These are things that were consigned to the shadows, they were deniable, and they were largely denied. However, now we have a situation in which the President of the United States not only can send forth paid assassins who are deniable assets and disposable assets, of course, the first rule of assassination, as it is said, is to kill the assassin so that the trail stops with him. But now, of course, the President of the United States commands the technology that allows remote killing by way of unmanned aerial drone robot aircraft that fire hellfire missiles. And the skies above the United States now are being plied by surveillance drones that are under the control of local law enforcement bodies that have been federalized and militarized and made part of this seamlessly integrated homeland security state. And just in the last week or two, we've seen some discussion now because the Obama administration released that 16-page legal memorandum created by the Office of Legal Counsel within the Justice Department that supposedly sets out the legal framework for discretionary killing by the executive branch. What it says, suggested to its foul essence, is that if the president decides to kill you, it's legal to do so because the president's powers are self-ratifying. This was something even the Bush administration didn't do back when Barack Obama was a freshman senator in the United States Senate and making noises as if he were at all interested in the Bill of Rights, the individual liberties protected thereby. He was a critic, albeit a somewhat muted and cynical and opportunistic one, of many of the abuses that characterized the Bush-Cheney administration. And once he ascended to the imperial purple, he picked up without hesitation or stint or limit.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is talking about his concern and my concern, and it should be your concern as well, about the use of drones armed with certainly hellfire or other rockets that are being used to kill people, being used to kill American citizens. In fact, certainly the people in Afghanistan, Afghanistan government here within the last 48 hours has launched a complaint. Because, of course, we launched a drone attack there in Afghanistan and ended up killing about 10 civilians. And the Afghans just don't think that's very nice. Now, we've been killing them on a routine basis in Pakistan, in fact, recently. Why, of course, we killed an American citizen who was not indicted, who had never been convicted of anything. He was an American citizen who apparently had been sympathetic with the terrorists. And he was over in Yemen. They killed him. But then a few weeks later, his 16-year-old son was over there looking for his father to make sure he was all right, and they sent a drone to kill this innocent American 16-year-old boy, American citizen, and one of his friends was with him. They were eating dinner in Yemen. And they simply had him killed. Now, well, basically, somebody had asked President Obama, you know, about the use of drones to kill Americans, and he said, I can assure you that no American has been killed and no American citizen has or will be killed in the United States. No American citizen will be killed in the United States. He didn't say that we're not going to kill American citizens in other countries. And then, of course, why should we believe anything that Barack Obama says? He's made statement after statement after statement that, frankly, aren't true. In fact, the purpose of government is to lie to people. And I can look back through the years, certainly in medicine, when they brought in Medicare, they said, look, doctors, you join Medicare. We've plenty of money. It's certainly physically sound. We'll pay you your regular and customary fee. We'll pay the hospitals the regular and customary fee. All we want to do is help people. That's what we're here for. Well, of course, and when they started it out, I was skeptical. I didn't think it could work. But it did work. It worked beautifully. And suddenly everybody was qualifying for Medicare or for Medicaid. And these government programs were for the patients we took care of before for nothing. Now we got well paid for it. It was just like a money tree. It was amazing. And they did exactly what they said they would do as far as paying the doctors, as far as paying the hospitals. But they didn't say how long that was going to be. And before very long, why, then they began to cut back on the doctor's fees, and they began to cut back on the hospital's fees, so that the hospitals lose money on every Medicare and Medicaid patients that they take in, but then they have to jack up the cost for the rest. And nobody tells the public why hospital costs are so high. It's simply because government is not paying for the Medicare and Medicaid patients, so they have to pass the care along, the cost along to the average individual. And the same thing is happening with doctors, because this new Obama bill they're going to be bringing in, they're going to have to cut off about half of the money that they have allotted for Medicare. And sure, that means that certainly that more and more doctors are going to simply just drop out of medicine. But don't you worry, they'll have a physician's assistant or a nurse or a nurse practitioner or something to provide medical care for the people. Yes, sirree, the government wants to take care of the people. And then, of course, we'll have the death panels. Basically, no doctor will be able to do what he wants to for you. A bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. will determine at what age they cut off your access to medical care. Will it be at 90 years of age, 80 years of age, 70 years of age, 50 years of age? Well, that'll depend upon how much money they have, because it has to be actuarially sound. Well, William, you go right ahead, because you were talking about your concern, a concern I share, about the very frightening fact that they have actually killed American citizens, but they were overseas, at least at this time. But when will they start killing Americans in the United States? And what right does the president have to order people killed without an indictment, without a trial, without even judicial review? Even the New York Times is concerned about that, and things have to be pretty bad before the New York Times would write an editorial saying there at least should be judicial review before we allow the killing of Americans in other countries without an indictment or criminal charges. Go right ahead.
The New York Times approach to this, of course, is to temporize rather than to condemn outright, and nothing other than a full-spectrum unqualified condemnation is suitable, because there is no colorable authority within the constitutional assignment of powers for the President of the United States to conduct discretionary killings of anybody. Now, Congress can issue letters of marque and reprisal. That's an entirely different situation, because at least you're talking in that instance about something that is derivative of the war powers that are assigned to the Congress by the Constitution. And this is something that has to be publicly deliberated, and that means that there would be the political equivalent to due process. In this instance, you're talking about the president composing within the executive branch a secretive body of unaccountable people who get together and compile kill lists that are not reviewable by anybody outside the executive branch, or even by limited exposure to select people within the Senate committees that oversee intelligence. You're talking about something that's entirely different, foreign to the American concept of law, antithetical to the small-r Republican institutions that the Constitution established. So you have to condemn this outright, because the president simply does not have legitimate authority to do this.
And I would point out, as William had said, this has been going on for a long time, but it has never been publicly announced. Certainly, I mean, if you have not listened to our 4-CD set on deadly assassins, where I interview several government assassins who were assigned assignment to kill people. One of them was assigned to kill a presidential candidate, and the other was assigned to kill a naval commander. Now, neither one of them carried out those orders. The murders that they did carry out for the government, they don't talk about. But you'll be fascinated to hear with them. And then, of course, the other one is an interview with a gentleman who had tracked down the man who was hired to kill General Patton. You remember General George Patton? Old blood and guts. Well, of course, he served his country valiantly and bravely, and his reward, why they killed him. Go right ahead.
the thing that I find really interesting about the way this issue is being molded is that, as with so many other instances, you alluded to this in your prologue to our conversation tonight, Dr. Stan. In so many instances, you have the powers that be sculpting an issue by setting up a phony dialectic where you have two supposedly opposed viewpoints that are contending, and they represent the furthermost extremes of acceptable contribution to the discussion. On the one hand, you've got a group of Democrats, including Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's looking to disarm the American public and says that she would love to have a situation where Mr. and Mrs. America would be ordered to turn in their guns. She's the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. When she had John Brennan, who is the keeper of the kill list and the nominee to be CIA director, before her Senate Intelligence Committee for confirmation hearings a little more than a week ago, she made a point of saying that nobody would be permitted to offer testimony apart from the nominee. That means that none of the legal scholars, none of the former policymakers who have been critics of the drone killing program would be permitted to testify. And her position, along with that of, I believe his name is Angus King, there's an independent senator, who has proposed that the Senate create a special judicial body in order to act as a supposed review body for the exercise of the drone killing function. It's amazing we're even talking about the exercise of the drone killing function in conversations now. But this would operate like the Foreign Intelligence Service or Surveillance Act, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, which was, I believe, passed about 35 years ago, actually. And it permits the federal government to engage in warrantless surveillance of suspected foreign agents and get a warrant after the fact. They're talking about having a drone court that would operate the same way. The president would order the kill would be consummated, and then a court would review it and ratify it after the fact. That's one position. The other position is that staked out by Republican Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who are reliable proponents of all things having to do with warfare and tyranny. They say that even having a court of that sort would be an impermissible intrusion on the purported authority of the President of the United States. So our alternatives here are, on the one hand, they have a court that ratifies things after the fact by way of a pure formality, or on the other hand, you have a president with unchecked and unreviewable power to order the summary execution of U.S. citizens. And then we have Nancy Pelosi chipping in just within the last couple of days. Nancy Pelosi, of course, is a reliable and inexhaustible Artesian geyser of the purest stupidity. When she was asked about Obamacare a couple of years ago, you'll remember, she said we'd have to pass it in order to find out what's in the bill. She's taken exactly the same position with respect to drones. Here's a wire service story that talks about a recent exchange she had on the subject. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi is not sure whether the public should be told when the federal government kills an American citizen. Maybe. It just depends, she said in an interview with the Huffington Post this week, when asked whether the administration should acknowledge when it targets a U.S. citizen in a drone strike. Pelosi disputed the assertion that the Democrats are less critical of the drone program than they would have been if George W. Bush were still president, arguing those opposed are pretty critical, and other people are just listening to see what this is and why this is necessary because we're in a different world. Okay, take that observation, transpose it into the partisan language of the Republicans. You have exactly the same type of apologia that was offered by Republicans in, say, 2004, 2006, when the subject was extraordinary rendition or torture or warrantless surveillance or any of the myriad ways that the Bush administration had shredded and perforated what remained of the protections of the Bill of Rights. But now that they have a Democrat president who's exercising powers that transcend even those claimed by George W. Bush, people like Nancy Pelosi, who occasionally did criticize George W. Bush for some of his excesses, are now sounding as if they're vintage George W. Bush apologists on Fox News from 7 or 8 years ago. And thus the dialectic proceeds. Both sides are statist, both sides are totalitarian, and neither side, of course, has anything but contempt for the rights that we are supposed to possess and that they are supposed to protect.
But what's frightening is there are no Republican leaders. Not one Republican leader, not one certainly conservative leader, not one religious leader has spoken out against torture, spoken out against this wanton killing of an American citizen. Where are religious leaders? Where are conservative leaders? We'll be back in a moment. Go right ahead, Miss.
Well, Dr. Stan, the thing about torture and the way that it has been introduced into the marrow of the American body politic is profoundly upsetting, because this is another subject where there had been a largely concealed practice going back decades, if not longer. I've talked about this before, but it's worth reviewing. Way back in 1898, when the United States invaded the Philippines in order to evict the Imperial Spaniards from that island chain, the Philippine insurrection against the Spanish believed that they were going to be set free and that they were going to be able to emulate the American War for Independence. But the problem was that they ended up under different imperial management. The Philippines, of course, were a coveted prize because it would have served as a coaling station, a naval way station, that is, for expansion into the distant east, into Asia. And so the problem was they had to find some way of pacifying Filipinos who wanted to rule themselves. And that resulted in the war that lasted for about 10 years and killed at least 100,000, perhaps a couple of 100,000 Filipinos, who were simply seeking for their independence from Spain or from the United States or from any other foreign power. Well, in the course of that war, it was necessary to extract intelligence from partisan fighters regarding planned attacks and ambushes on American troops. That's the sort of thing that happens when you take up the imperial burden. People resent your presence, and they will organize to evict you. That doesn't matter whether you're Spanish or British or Russian or American. They don't want you there. They want to rule themselves, and they will throw you out of their country by any means possible. And that means that if you're going to retain control of this contested territory, you're going to have to do things that are morally unsupportable, such as torturing people. And in the Philippines, in that epoch, it was the practice of military interrogators to use that method of controlled drowning that is now called waterboarding. It was called the water cure back in 1898, 1899, the early years of the 20th century. It was derivative of torture used in some epochs of the Spanish Inquisition when it was called El Tormento de Agua. The same idea, controlled drowning, not simulated drowning, controlled drowning. And so there were many, many instances where this was used in the Philippines. It was condemned by a number of people here in the United States. There were religious leaders at the time who would condemn this practice because they recognized that it was not compatible with Christian ethics, and it brought nothing but shame and disgrace upon the image of the United States. There were actual trials that were held of command officers who had ordered, authorized, or covered up the practice of torture. Nobody was sent to prison for this. Nobody was imposed. No serious fines or professional sanctions were imposed, but there was an effort in any case to hold people accountable, however inadequate that effort would have been. And it wasn't until about 25 years after the end of the Philippine War for Independence that you had a final accounting of the domestication of that practice, because it had been incorporated by many municipal police departments into that set of rough interrogation tactics called the third degree. The third degree, of course, something you read about in old detective fiction, you've heard referred to in old movies. Supposedly that would involve sweating somebody under a bare light bulb, abusing him verbally, making grandiose but legally permissible threats about the length of his incarceration, psychologically trying to force him to confess. When that didn't work, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, in, I believe, Boston, certainly in New York.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply going into the background of the torture that was used during the Philippine-American War. Most people never even heard of the Philippine-American War, but it followed the Spanish-American War and went from about 1900, 1901. Four or five years, maybe 10 years. Anyway, it was a long war, and because it was standard to torture the Filipinos. After all, the American troops were there, and those little brown men didn't appreciate us being there. They wanted to be free, and so our military tortured them. And they used the standard waterboarding techniques. And basically, of course, I mean, this was well over 100 years ago. But at least in those days, some of the ministers had the courage to speak out. But of course, that would be unpatriotic today. And people have forgot that men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And ministers and politicians become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And I fear that God is going to be very unhappy, or is very unhappy with America. And I really believe, of course, as Thomas Jefferson says, that suddenly God, who gave his life, gave his liberty, but does the liberty of a nation be secure when the conviction has been forgotten that liberty is the gift of God? I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and his justice will not sleep forever. The words are chiseled into the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., and never, never quoted in America. Go right ahead, will you?
Never quoted in America except by retromagent reactionary throwbacks like you and me, Dr. Stiff, because
right,
something that haunts me as well is that unavoidable bedrock principle here of accountability, ultimate accountability to our Creator. But when I was referring earlier to the fact that this practice called the water cure had been domesticated. It was used by police departments in some of the large municipalities, including New York and Chicago, primarily, I believe, Boston, Philadelphia, and a number of other places. It was incorporated into the third degree. The one really nasty thing about this, Dr. Stan, is that it actually originated with the municipal police departments, particularly in New York City. The commander, the field commander of the Philippines, who introduced the water cure, had been a high-ranking police official. He was a Tammany-era holdout as somebody who had used this routinely in order to get people to confess, and then took that overseas to the Philippines, where it gestated, and then it bloomed into something really ugly, and then they imported it to the United States. It wasn't until the 1930s that the American Bar Association, one of the few useful things that organization ever did, succeeded in exposing this through the Wickersham Commission hearings, and that resulted in changes and prosecutions and lustrations of various corrupt departments and so forth. This is all done because we still had a functioning conscience. Fast forward 100 years. In the interim between, say, 1913 and 2013, there was a war in the Pacific in which U.S. soldiers were captured and held as prisoners of war by the Imperial Japanese, and several of them, many of them, were subjected to water torture. Waterboarding, as we would now call it, and there were Japanese command officers and commandants and prison camp guards who were put on trial for war crimes and then sent to the gallows because they had used the water cure, they'd used waterboarding against U.S. POW. But the thing is, the United States introduced that practice in the occupied Philippines before the Japanese took over that archipelago in the early years of the Pacific War. So fast forward another 50 or 60 years, and suddenly you have a situation where former Vice President Cheney, interviewed within the last couple of days on network television, said waterboarding is not torture. Just as a flat, unqualified statement, as if it were a categorical truth, when it is not only a form of torture, widely, universally recognized as such, except by partisans of the American warfare state, but it has been considered a capital offense. And this is perfectly emblematic of the deep-dyed corruption of the system under which we live. And unfortunately, and this is another fact that we discussed before, but it's a source of self-replenishing astonishment to me, when polls were taken several years ago, longitudinal studies of attitudes across cultural and religious boundaries on a global scale regarding the acceptability of torture, the single largest social cohort of any of the populations studied in the United States, in Asia, in Europe, in Latin America, in the Middle East, that supported torture were American evangelical Christians. There was a higher percentage of American evangelical Christians who supported torture than there was of Chinese who supported torture, or even of fundamentalist Muslims who supported torture.
But that is because
that's indictment.
That is because George Bush supported it. Exactly. Everybody believed George Bush was an evangelical Christian. Well, I know. I've talked to George W. Bush. I shook hands with him. I looked into his eyes, and I said to myself, here's the most dishonest, dangerous person I've probably ever met. He would just look so affable, and I'll never forget. John Stormer and I sat there. We're standing there together with George W. Bush, and we could see through him, but the tragedy is all the other Christians who are with us, they were all taken in. this is Dr. Stan. Go right ahead, William.
I understand and recognize and share your frustration over the way that people become attached to personalities and then on the basis of that attachment extrapolate some moral justification for supporting what that political figure, what that political personality does, and rationalize it as somehow acceptable from a Christian perspective when you're talking about making aggressive war or authorizing torture or generalized political dishonesty. We profess in this country, most of us still, to be Christians. That is to say that we believe that Jesus of Nazareth was and is divinity, that what he taught was gospel truth, not merely good news, but eternal truth, and that we would live according to the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount. But when it comes to matters of public policy, most of us are statists. Our religion is statism. We believe that the state somehow is immune to the moral law to the extent that people with whom we share a partisan affinity are running the mechanisms of the state. And that simply is irreconcilable with what was taught by Jesus of Nazareth. It's irreconcilable with basic morality as inscribed on our hearts by the being who created us. But this is a symptom of severe politics that trends toward totalitarianism, the idea that what's really important is that the right people exercise power against the right target. And both sides of this engineered divide, this arbitrary, useless, deceptive arrangement, both sides embrace that principle. Both sides want to be the who rather than the whom in that equation. And they alternate, as Carol Quigley pointed out, by way of prescription rather, in Tragedy and Hope. He said that the two parties should be fundamentally identical, that you can throw the bums out every 4 years if necessary, and you'd end up with no dramatic shifts in policy, but you placate the public. You give them the illusion here that there's some kind of change in administration that represents a material alteration of the way that government runs.
Hold that thought, and we'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grigg, and he's simply talking. He's quoting, of course, from a Professor Carol Quigley, who was a liberal college professor at Harvard and Princeton before he went to Georgetown University, and of course, wrote his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And it's a classic book. If you haven't read it, you need to, because it introduces you to the secret society that Professor Quigley was privy to. He was actually told about it by one of the members. He did a lot of research on this, and it is simply the fundamental book on the secret society that controls America today. But as of course Professor Quigley says on pages 1247 to 1246-47 of his book, you know, basically we seem to have two political parties that are exactly the same. And so the people can go to the polls every 4 years and throw the rascals out, but the foreign and domestic policies remain the same. And that's exactly what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. Certainly the elections we hold every 4 years are simply for your entertainment. But it really doesn't matter, because as Professor Quigley, and he wrote this book in 1966, said, basically, you let the people go to the polls every 4 years to throw the rascals out. Those are his words. But of course, the foreign and domestic policy will stay the same, and that's exactly what it is. What is our foreign policy? Why, of course, it's to bring about a world socialist government. What's our domestic policy? To make everyone dependent upon the government, to bring the basic Marxist techniques and policies and power so that the people will support the government no matter how tyrannical and immoral it is. Go right ahead, William.
People always, of course, have a sense of buying into one side or another, that they've invested themselves in one of these controlled factions, and that the only way that they can be effective and have a seat at the table is by compromising their professed principles in order to advance the interests of the collective to which they've been assigned or to which they've adhered. And that's the way that the game is played in Washington, and that's the way that the game is played for public consumption. And what Carol Quigley was describing, of course, was a cynical spectator sport. It wasn't statecraft. It was an illusion. It was a facade. It was something which was done in order to conceal the workings of the people who actually dispose of power in our system. But people in our society have become wedded to the collectivist notion that what is really important is to make sure that you're part of a group, part of a cohort that exercises power. And the way that our public conversations about politics are structured is that you are assigned a certain number of acceptable talking points that are within the ambit of acceptable discussion. And if you actually address matters of public concern from a principled perspective, chances are people aren't going to be able to hear what you say. They will hear what they think you're saying from the perspective of a collectivist. I'll give you a really good example. About a year ago, I wrote an essay reviewing a book, a memoir, by the regrettably now deceased Chris Kyle, who was a Navy SEAL sniper in Iraq for the most part. And in that book, he talked about the fact that he was credited with about 160 kills. And the first kill that he engaged in was a very long shot to kill an Iraqi woman who was going to throw a hand grenade at a group of U.S. Marines. I don't want to see U.S. Marines getting killed, obviously. I don't want to see anybody getting killed, obviously, but particularly when I'm talking about this from the perspective of an American, I don't want to see American lives being wasted in wars that have nothing to do with protecting our country. I don't want to see them killed. I don't want to see them maimed. I don't want to see them left unsound of mind. That means that you stay out of foreign adventurism. That's how it's supposed to work. The problem is that Iraqi woman was described by Kyle as somebody who had a twisted soul who was simply seized upon with irrational hatred, and he felt no remorse at all about killing this woman who was defending her home from foreign aggression. You see, there's no recognition here of the universal human right to defend one's home and one's family against foreign aggression, which is why we shouldn't have policymakers putting American soldiers in the position of being aggressors. But that was something that was a leitmotif in the book, that Mr. Kyle couldn't recognize the fact that by violating the non-aggression principle, the United States government had put him and his colleagues in the position of acting like imperial invaders, and Iraqis in the position of having to fight back in order to reclaim their home from the armies of a foreign government that, after all, had installed Saddam Hussein and propped him up and given him the means to make their lives miserable. And later on in that book, Chris Kyle made mention of the fact that during one of his furloughs, when he was at home with his family in Texas, somebody broke into his home. A robber, in other words, committed an act of aggression against his home and family, and so what he did was he grabbed his gun and he went to confront the man, who was, of course, took to heels and ran away. He fled from the scene. And he went on to some length, Mr. Kyle did, about how infuriated he was by this violation of the sanctity of his property and how he wanted to kill the SOB who dares set foot on his home and put his family at risk. And that's, of course, an entirely human impulse. He was right to do what he did. What he can't understand, of course, is that the Iraqis felt the same way about the Americans who had invaded their country. They were there without permission. They were there doing no good to anybody. And so, like Americans would do in similar circumstances, they did whatever they could to drive the foreigners out of the country. Now, that's not to say that everybody who was fighting against the U.S. invasion was an Iraqi patriot. There were many people who were opportunistically flocked to that country in order to wreak havoc upon it. This is something that was done by way of conscious policy. If you take a look at the alliances that were made by the U.S. government after the initial invasion with some really nasty sectarian forces in Iraq, it's pretty clear that the very worst of the worst, who were terrorists, were bought off in the so-called surge and became allies of the United States government in foisting an even worse government on that long-suffering country. But I wrote this about a year ago, and of course, Mr. Kyle was killed a couple of weeks ago by a fellow Iraq veteran who, having had similar experiences, suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder, and at the shooting range, whatever derangement this unfortunate young man suffered came to a head, and it resulted in the apparent murder of Chris Kyle and one of their friends. So because Chris Kyle was killed a couple of weeks ago and his name was thrust into the spotlight, people are going back and rereading the essay I wrote a year ago, many of them mistakenly believing that I posted this after his death by way of denigrating his character, after he was no longer among the living, which of course is something I wouldn't do. I would not be at all interested in adding to the anguish of his wife and children, whom he had been from whom he'd been separated while he was deployed overseas in these stupid, useless, pointless wars. But most of the letters I've received tardily, by way of sort of a belated reply to what I published a year ago, begin with the assumption that because I opposed the war in Iraq, and because I was critical of the fact that the U.S. military was involved in this war of aggression, that I must therefore be a left-winger who supports and applauds Barack Obama. Because, of course, that's the collective to which I have been assigned in this engineered narrative. You simply cannot, as a patriot, as a conservative, as a constitutionalist, as a Christian, you simply cannot be opposed to any military venture anywhere on the face of the planet, because according to the arbitrary rules that have been set to define how a conservative responds to these issues, you have to be an unflinching and unqualified supporter of the military wherever they go, is irrespective of the identity of the people whom they've been sent to kill.
But, you know, William, I understand that, because for so many years I supported the Vietnam War,
yeah.
And I thought that anybody who opposed it was a communist, and I sort of known, I mean, I'd been around for a good long while, but I felt so deeply about, certainly, the boys that were committed over there in Vietnam and were risking their lives, and I really thought that somehow they were there fighting communism, because communism was the terrible enemy. And it wasn't really until I began to understand that we were actually funding the Russians, who were funding the North Vietnamese, who were funding the South Vietnamese, that we never intended to win the war.
Yeah.
When I was told by the American ambassador to Laos, William H. Sullivan, he told me, I spent a very enjoyable hour with him. He said, you know, I never understood that war. He said, we could have won it in 6 weeks. I never understood why we didn't just invade North Vietnam and win the war. And I was told the same thing by four-star Marine General Lew Wald, who I became a very close friend of. And, he was a wonderful, wonderful patriot. And he said, you know, we could have won the war in 6 weeks. And only when I began to understand the war was as phony as a $3 bill, did I begin to realize that all these people supporting the war were simply had never stopped and thought about it. We were not fighting communism there. They fought a 10-year war simply as a great diversion, so the American people would not understand that, of course, we were bringing in the Great Society. The Vietnam was fought so that we could bring in Medicare and Medicaid and all of these wonderful socialist programs, and Richard Nixon went right along with fighting a 10-year unnecessary war, and we killed 58,000 American soldiers, courageous soldiers, patriotic soldiers. We killed them for nothing. This was a plain murder. We killed 1 million South Vietnamese and 2 million North Vietnamese in a totally unnecessary war. And I look back on it and I say, how could I have been so stupid? So I don't really criticize people who are stupid today. I just say what we've got to do is educate them. And I understand why people support the war in Iraq, because they've never stopped and realized, why are we there? What was the justification for going in? And if somebody was coming in and suddenly destroying our homes and killing our sons and daughters, wouldn't we strike back at them just like the Vietnamese did? Go right ahead.
And what's happened with the Iraq War is that in the name of supposedly fighting radical Islam, the United States government sent U.S. military personnel to Iraq to fight and kill and die on behalf of Sharia law, because the Constitution of Iraq that was created by the Coalition Provisional Authority and imposed upon that country with great fanfare about 8 years ago enshrines Islamic law as the only source of legislation for the country. That was true under Saddam Hussein. He was, of course, a Ba'ath Party National Socialist, which is a pretty nasty ideology. And I don't have any brief for that, and I obviously don't have any brief for the Sharia-compliant government the Iraqis are now living under. But the point is, these patriotic young men who enlisted in the military, many of them after 9/11, thinking that it was their duty to go and smite the Amalekite heathens who subscribed to Islam, which, as a Christian, I believe is a horrible, soul-destroying heresy at very best, they believed that that was their vocation and their mission. They felt a patriotic urge to do this, and they ended up fighting many of them, and many of them suffering, bleeding, becoming disabled or crippled or once again burdened with psychological trauma, as part of a warp to impose a Sharia-compliant constitution on what had been a secular country. Same kind of thing that you see with the bait and switch in Vietnam. But these are things, of course, that we're not supposed to discuss because this transgresses the establishment's guidelines for acceptable discussion. You cannot, as a Christian, conservative, libertarian-leaning, patriotic American, oppose any war that the United States gets involved in at any time for any reason, because that doesn't follow the script. Thing is, if you take a look at what's going on right now with the Obama left, is that they're reveling in the dictatorial powers that Mr. Obama inherited and has enlarged upon. There's a writer for whom I have guarded respect by the name of David Sirota. I believe he lives in Montana. He's a lefty. He's somebody who's very wrong, consistently wrong about very many important issues. But he is mortified by the fact that the peace movement dissipated entirely when Mr. Obama became president, and now it has become an unabashed cheerleader for unaccountable, presidentially sanctioned wars of aggression, including the drone war. Witness what Nancy Pelosi said about how we may or may not be able to tell you if an American citizen is killed in a drone strike. And Nancy Pelosi, by the way, went on to say, you know what, you look at the polls, this is popular. Obviously, the people support this because they believe that they're being protected. So, the logic here is that we've deceived them about what's going on because they bought the deception. That means that the deception is sound policy. But in this piece that David Sirota published about 2 days ago, it's entitled The Blind Theology of Militarism, and he's talking once again about this horrible religion of statism. He quotes Angus King, that's the independent senator from Maine, who has proposed a drone court that would ratify the drone strikes after the fact. What Senator King said is the following. He's a lefty, once again. Drones are a lot more civilized than what we used to do. I think it's actually a more humane weapon because it can be targeted to specific enemies and specific people. And Sirota goes on to talk about all these other people who were at least nominal critics of the warfare state under Bush, who are now pontificating upon the wonderful, sophisticated, judicious use of arbitrary killing by a president they support, this nitwit Touré on MSNBC, he's a 30-something commentator, went into great lengths and to great depths praising Barack Obama for making use of these powers. One of his co-hosts there lately said, yes, as a matter of fact, I guess I would be hypocritical because I think that you can trust Barack Obama with this power, but you couldn't trust George W. Bush or Mitt Romney with this power of arbitrary killing. And that, of course, is pure, unfiltered collectivism of the sort we're describing here. What matters ultimately to these people is who does what to whom. They insist on being the who, they want us to be the whom, and the what doesn't matter. But you know what? People who understand liberty and the real concept of the rule of law understand that what is done is the really important question.
And I think it's so vitally important that for people to understand that we're told, you know, there's a conflict between the Democrats and Republicans, an ideological conflict, a conflict between the right and the left, the conservative and the liberal. And people don't understand it's all as phony, basically. They're all controlled by exactly the same people, but they want us to be out there arguing back and forth. They want us to give us this idea that, you know, we have a choice. We do not have a choice. Both sides are controlled by exactly the same people. And until people understand that, very little going on today makes any sense. Go right ahead.
That's exactly what's happening now, is that they want people to become irretrievably wedded to the idea that their particular faction, their team, their party, their clique, their club, is uniquely qualified to exercise these powers. What's important is to keep these powers in the right hands.
Well, I'm going to interrupt you there because we're getting to the edge of the program, and I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your website and how they can get to your PayPal button.
Dr. Stan, I appreciate that. My website is called Pro Libertate, ProLibertate, and then the direct web address is freedominourtime.blogspot.com, freedominourtime.com. As one word, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, or go to Google or another search engine, type in my name, William N. Grigg. Pro Libertate should be the first result. At the end of every essay, there's a PayPal button for those who have access to PayPal and are interested in helping to provide me with a way to provide for my family. Be very grateful for any help that you can offer, and we are eternally grateful to you, Dr. Stan. And the many generous people in your audience who've donated to us and been so thoughtful and solicitous toward us. This is our chief means of support, and we are very, very grateful for all the kind help that we've received.
And I'm very grateful for your writing our newsletter, and if you're out there in a position to help William Y., but he's certainly very important, one of the most articulate people we have, certainly within the conservative movement today. And Barbara and I support William, and I hope you will as well if you're capable of it. We'll be back in a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Well, William, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program tonight.
Dr. Stan, it's always been a blessing to be with you, and I really do appreciate everything that you've done. Not only for me and my family, but for our country and for the cause of truth. I should point out that I also am a contributor to lewrockwell.com, lewrockwell.com. Lew Rockwell is the chairman of the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama, and he is, of course, an exponent of the Austrian School of Economics, which is free market economics. If you go to lewrockwell.com right now, lewrockwell.com, as in Norman Rockwell, lewrockwell.com, at the very top of the page, there's a link to an interview that I did with Lew Rockwell a couple of days ago about the Chris Dorner case and related issues having to do with the metastasizing police state. It's a podcast that was recorded, I believe, Thursday morning when a lot of what had happened was still fresh in our memories. I wanted to mention something I didn't get around to talking about this evening, which was the official doctrine of state terror in the Soviet Union. There was the head of the Soviet secret police by the name of M.I. Lassen. This is from page 96 of the Gulag Archipelago by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He wrote the following: in the interrogation of a suspect, do not seek evidence and proof that the person accused acted in word or deed against Soviet power. The first question should be, what is his class, what is his origin, what is his education and upbringing? These are the questions which must determine the fate of the accused. That's exactly what we're talking about here. What matters in our system, albeit it's a somewhat derivative and somewhat attenuated version of what the Soviets dealt with, what matters is what party you belong to, what club you belong to, what faction you support. What matters is not what is done, but rather who is doing what to whom. That's the way that we are being manipulated into embracing totalitarianism in this country. We have a different dear leader every 4 or 8 years, and he brings in his train a different constituency, different pressure groups. That's not how America is supposed to function. We're supposed to be ruled by law, rooted in the laws of nature and nature's God, rather than in considerations of collectivist pressure groups and collectivist interests. We have to re-enthrone the genuine rule of law in this country, or our country's fate is sealed, and it's an unpleasant one.
And it's so tragic that Republicans, I mean, many of them are God-fearing Christians, are suddenly back what the Republicans do without question, are suddenly willing to go to war as long as it's to protect America. But how suddenly did our attack on Afghanistan and Iraq defend America? How did our attack on Vietnam defend America? And of course, it didn't. It's about time we got people thinking and thinking clearly. And that's, of course, why I do what I do, and that's why you do what you do as well, William. God bless you. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Thank you. God bless you, Doctor.
And you too. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're able to do what we do because we have people out there who do believe in what we're doing and do support us. And if you're in a position to help us, we'd love to hear from you. As you know, we have about 50 outlets every single week now, and we actually reach people all across America, indeed, across the world, through the miracle of shortwave, through the internet. And of course, if you have an iPod or an iPhone, you can get our programs 24 hours a day on the internet. If you have a telephone with unlimited minutes, you can listen to our 2-hour afternoon program at Genesis. And of course, if you have a KU satellite, YU band satellite, you can hear our programs shortwave, you can hear us. But of course, it's all an expensive proposition. So if you can help, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. And if you're not in a position to help, then we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Let me mention once again, of course, if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it, and you need to read it, and you need to lend it to others. And if you agree that this is a worthwhile and important book, then maybe you'd like to help us get it reprinted. This will be the last reprinting for me. I'm going to be 84 on Sunday, and so I'm probably not going to have another reprinting, but if you'd like to, get a case of the books. You can get them for less than $2.40 each. You can pass them out. You can certainly lend them out. You can sell them. Do whatever you want to. But here's an excellent weapon for you to utilize to change other people's lives. So we're almost halfway to having the sufficient support to get the book published or republished. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like the book or you'd like to get a case of the books. And then, of course, we hope you'll want to get my talk on the Agenda 21, covert plan. You can get certainly Michael Shaw's excellent talk, Agenda 21, the wretching transformation of America, because that's what it is. You'll certainly want to get my talk on on population control, the covert agenda, because they've already killed billions of people. Let me repeat that. They've either killed or prevented the births of billions of people, and they intend to kill billions more. This is not imaginary. It's very real. These people are very, very sincere. We're moving towards another major war. This one's going to be in the Middle East. That is, of course, why we've destroyed the governments of Egypt and of Tunisia and Libya, and why we're, of course, certainly fomenting the war in Syria. About 70,000 people have died now. Latest figures, several million have been displaced from their homes. Suddenly, hundreds of thousands are living in other countries. Your tax dollars at work, ladies and gentlemen. Well, that, and of course, the drug money that the CIA raises from the poppy fields in Afghanistan. One reason we had to go into Afghanistan is because the Taliban had closed down the poppy fields and it was cutting off CIA funding. The CIA has a division that deals in drugs. If you doubt that, if you said that's the most incredible thing I ever saw, go up on the internet and simply type in CIA funds of funded by opium, the CIA funded by drugs. Type that into your search engine and you'll find it's true. Learn how to use the internet. Learn how to verify the things we're saying and then help us reach people across America. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com, and you can go there and listen to our programs. Certainly live 4 hours a day. Certainly you can listen to the archive programs 24 hours a day. And then, of course, we hope that you'll read our newsletters, you'll watch our DVDs, and then that you'll tell others, encourage them to listen, and tell them that this will give them the information they're going to need to be able to survive and begin making your preparations, ladies and gentlemen, because there are going to be some terrifying things happening this year. I don't know exactly what's going to be happening, but I do believe that the resignation of the Pope foretells something. We're going to do a number of programs on that next week. And then please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and our protection. And so until next week at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.
Let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices,
ladies and gentlemen, to the Power Hour Radio Show. It is the day. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It is the day we've been waiting for. Why? The Supreme Court today. I'll tell you about that. It's a big day at the Supreme Court. Also, and it may be a big day for a meteor, too. And if we are told the truth, like Russia must have been told the truth about the meteor that hit them and hurt 500 people. But, oh, don't worry. It won't come near this earth. Who knows? I don't know. Who do you trust? But it hit 500 people. Can you imagine? I mean, people at their desks all of a sudden just blown out of their desks. Incredible what happened in Russia. But, of course, we were affixed to the TVs in this country, watching a ship go 1 mile an hour.